This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Durham native Molly Dektar released her debut novel this year. The Ash Family is a composite of Molly's personal experience on traditional farms and her fascination with cult psychology. The protagonist, Barry, yearns for a more essential life and abandons her plans for college. Instead, she joins an isolated farming commune near Asheville, North Carolina. Members of the Ash family forsake personal histories in favor of the cult's fervent environmentalism. Barry's chores include shepherding, dumpster diving, and bomb making. Bucolic mountain scenery and direct action protest entrap Barry in a culture of patriarchal coercion, and that is some of the Ash family, written by Molly Dektar, who joins us now. Hello, Molly.
Hello, Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
Good to have you. Set up a little bit more of this novel now and give us a little deeper picture of what happens in The Ash Family.
Absolutely. So The Ash Family is my first novel. It's a book about a young woman named Barry who runs away from home to live on an off-the-grid homestead farm that turns out to be a cult. And she ends up there. She's supposed to be going to college, but instead she sort of turns tail and goes to the mountains, to Asheville. And she meets this, you know, handsome guy at the bus stop on Tunnel Road. And he invites her to come home to what he calls the real world, which is a communal farm of about 30 people in the mountains there near Asheville. And not everything is as it seems. You know, there's some murder that ensues, some love. Barry falls deeper and deeper into the spell of this community.
It is a quick turnaround for Barry. As you say, she's on her way to college, and then this other opportunity emerges, which is a complete transformation in terms of lifestyle. So describe her immediate reaction to what she sees. She'll learn more later, but her immediate reaction to this kind of communal lifestyle.
Yeah, well, at first she comes to the farm and really admires the people there and feels that they seem to follow different rules that she doesn't understand. And I was listening to the piece right before me. She compares the people she meets there to astronauts because they seem otherworldly somehow. And right away, they get her herding sheep, which is something that I had to do when I worked on farms. And it's terrifying. If the sheep run away from you and you're not an experienced shepherd, you know that you're going to have to be running a lot to find them and bring them back to the barn. And so they throw her into this difficult task immediately.
Yeah, so first there's just the reality and the hardship of having to live the life, this back-to-the-land kind of a life, which is a reality. And then, of course, as you say, some of the darker sides of this come through. There is a leader, and this is where the cult-like aspects begin to emerge as the novel unfolds, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The leader's name is Dice, and he has a lot of rules that people have to follow. And he really grounds the rules. He says, we have to live right by the environment. You know, climate change is real and happening, and people have been living incorrectly in this wasteful way. And if you want to do right by nature, you know, join me and follow, you know, these self-abnegating rules. We all, you know, we have to suppress our own desires for the good of nature. And there's, you know, good and bad parts to his philosophy, but he's certainly an autocratic leader.
Right, and this is the insidious kind of seduction. On the one hand, you can buy the argument that we're doing horrific things to the environment, and then, well, here's how to fix it. Lose your own history, become part of our history, and this is the world. This will be transformative, but it does mean that this gives certain individuals, including Dice, some absolute control, which becomes ultimately the end game, at least as far as they're concerned.
Yeah, absolutely.
Barry adopts this lifestyle pretty quickly, though. It is seductive, and she starts to forget her own history. Maybe I can ask you to read a section that gives us a sense of her transformation.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll read from around the end of the first third of the book, and this is one of her first times off of the farm, and she's visiting a town with another member of the family named Bay. As we drove, I had the sense that life was moving too quickly for me. Bay told me that last year a giant icicle had fallen from the barn and skewered a lamb straight through the throat. Dice wanted me to kill a lamb today, I said. Bay said nothing. As a result of the lamb or the icicle or Bay, I shuddered. Deep down, I liked to shudder, There was some circuit in my body and the wires were touching. I didn't want to be like my mother and end up in a world where I was always cautious. The back lot of the Ingalls Market shone like a mirage. I hadn't seen pavement since September, 5 months before, and it was so smooth it resembled a carpet. My feet hit the asphalt too hard. The air smelled chemical. I didn't recognize this as the world I'd left behind. We filled 4 trash barrels with bruised produce, mushrooms in little wooden baskets, perfectly soft mangoes, plastic cartons of cherry tomatoes, zucchinis wrapped in plastic, bell peppers, hands of spotty bananas. I tried to ask whether I needed to make amends with Dice, but Bay ignored me. I wish Dice trusted me more, I said. We had begun to load our barrels into the trunk, heaving them up when he finally spoke. Trust, Bay said, and turned his big face toward me, which was fringed with power and light, like a crude drawing of the sun. That's on you, babe. I'm leaving tomorrow to find us new family, he said, reliable family. He was provoking me, of course.
Molly Dektar reading from her debut novel, The Ash Family. Now, this is, as we said earlier in the introduction, based somewhat on your experience. You lived on a farm, maybe not a cult, but certainly this kind of a life. Talk about your own experience.
Yeah, so after college, I got a grant to travel and interview farmers about their experiences with climate change. And I ended up working on a number of different small-scale farms over a year, and I got so interested in living that way. I also, at one point, worked on a farm near Asheville, a horse-powered farm that informed the Suffolk Punch horses that you would read about in my book. But I, in general, you know, like Barry, she has this recurring phrase where she says, I wanted a more essential life. And I think that a lot of us, in trying to figure out how we're going to respond to climate change, wish there was something we could really do, you know, on behalf of nature that's more intense than changing light bulbs and recycling. And so that's what really drove me to work with animals and, you know, doing planting and watching the seasons pass on these small farms.
Yeah, there is the, I think, noble desire to be the change you seek. But it can, in some cases, devolve because others take advantage of that and create these situations where they use it as a power platform. Did you experience any of that cult personalities, people who were misusing this instinct in people?
Yeah, perhaps my cultiest experience during that time farming, I was in rural Norway, and I found myself on a farm. And the man who ran the farm truly believed he was 5,000 years old, and he believed he had access to special knowledge. And during that time, I got sick. I think I had the flu or something like that. And rather than going to a doctor, he tried to cure me by ringing bells. And what's interesting is, I think in my normal day-to-day life, I would demand to go see a doctor or, you know, go find conventional medicine. But there, because I was in the middle of this, you know, dark Norwegian forest and I'd been living there 2 months in my own cabin and so on, it felt like it would be rude to make demands. I also wanted, you know, to fit in with him and his family. I was also sort of in an addled space because I wasn't feeling well. And all those things combined to allow me to let him set the terms. And that sort of feeling Barry feels as well. There's such a mixture that leads you to follow. And it's not, you know, you can know with part of your mind that it's irrational, and with the other part, because of social pressure and also wanting to believe, you can let yourself go.
Yeah, well, this, I think, is the great paradox of idealism and of, you know, this kind of a lifestyle, because you, when you superimpose the ideal, I mean, I think we used to think the problem, you know, the argument about in favor of idealism used to be the counter was, well, it's not practical. And some crotchety old guy would tell you, you know, you need to be practical and, you know, make compromise. And the young hippie would say, but no, we can't sacrifice our ideals. And then you come to realize, no, idealism is another form of narcissism. It's another form of me superimposing myself on the natural world because the idea running through my head is better than anything nature could have provided. I mean, did you find yourself with that kind of a conflict and an understanding of what the ideals behind the rules of a commune could be over and against the instinct to be better about, you know, your relationship with nature?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these things are so complicated. And on the one hand, you know, cult, the word itself is pejorative. It always means something bad. But the sort of structure in a cult, I think, can be used for good. You know, having a tight group of people who truly, truly care about an issue and want to live communally and want to live by their ideals, all those things are good and necessary, I think, to address certain causes. So there's a lot of gray in the book. I mean, in the end, this community is evil. But I think there are amazing examples of extremely successful movements and communes with strong leaders or with, you know, a very clear purpose that achieve great things. So it can certainly go both ways, and I think it's just important to keep your eyes open to the complexity of these matters.
Yeah, I wonder if I can ask you to read again from the novel.
Oh, absolutely. Just a moment. So I'll read from a bit later in the book when things have started to get harder and harder for Barry, the main character, but she still really, really wants to live at this farm. Every day, I woke up and considered if I wanted to keep going. Every day, I pulled up fewer and fewer reasons, like rifling the algal floor of a depleted wishing well. Time continued thundering forward. The water in the swollen streams came from ice packed around the roots of trees, snow in the coves and shadows. The faraway ocean sucked it all home, tugged it violently through brimming channels. And every year, more of our 4-mile-high mountains got dragged along with it. The ephemerals, the trillium and bleeding hearts, ladies' slippers and crested dwarf hearts, swiftly neared the twilight of their growing season, and the irises and daffodils began to rip open their bulbs. Here came the millions of black summer flies in the milk in the way. When we sliced cheese for dinner, we found their corpses crouched in air bubble caves produced by their own bacteria. After dinner, the sheep sat in meadows whose flowers were taller than they were. The milk was at high tide. The strawberries bloomed in a matter of days. The sow swelled like a balloon and gave birth to a litter of 10. They fell out into my hand one after another. The next day, the piglets nibbled the paws of the sleeping dogs. We dug out the garden, weeded, reaped. The more you harvest, the more you get, because plants are so indefatigable and desperate to get their seeds into the world. Every time you clip a zucchini, the zucchini plant will try again. Dice told a story about scientists who, for all their technologies, really had no way to check if there was a meteor hiding behind the sun heading right toward us. And why shouldn't there be? We're about due for a mass extinction.
Molly Dektar, author of The Ash Family, a novel about cult lifestyle, power, and environmentalism. Talk about the process you used to do this, because as you say, you've really got these complex notions all woven together in the form of characters who have to embody these things, right? Doing sometimes the wrong things for the right reasons, doing the right things for the wrong reasons, and all of that. How do you develop these characters, and is there a formula for keeping them complex and keeping the paradox alive? Because you can easily sort of turn these into good guys and bad guys.
Yeah, it's one of the things I've been so fortunate to be able to publish this book. And in the time since it's come out, I've sometimes been in position to tell people about the craft of writing and, you know, offer advice. And one of the key things I learned in workshops that I tell everyone is if you make a character evil, make them 51% evil. And if you make a character good, make them 51% good. The idea is everyone in a story or novel, and I really believe this is true, ought to be sort of an edge case. You don't want, you know, like ultra heroic unless you're, I don't know, writing an allegory, something that isn't literary fiction. And so the leader of the cult here, Dice, I'd say he's just 51% evil. And he came about because I wanted to write a nature story, but I also really wanted there to be stakes and, you know, plot and some page-turning thing. And nature itself can be so diffuse. It all has to do with seasonal change and sort of slow things. And so Dice is kind of, in a way, an outgrowth of the nature theme, just nature come to life to force Barry into committing more and more of herself to live rightly by it.
I wonder if you wrote this novel out of a sense, or where was the place, your starting place, in terms of your hope for us and the planet? Were you writing out of a sense of despair, out of a sense of hope, idealism? Where did you start?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, reading nature stories, I find so incredibly, you know, beautiful and I love reading Wendell Berry, for example, and I love, one of my favorite books ever is Little House in the Big Woods. So I love reading about encounters with nature that respect nature. And on the other hand, yes, absolutely despair and confusion, kind of like what can I as an individual do in the face of this massive collective action problem, which is dealing with climate change? And that confusion is reflected in the book, which is not at all a manual for how you should live, or, you know, it's not an example of a good community, but it is an example of people really trying to grapple with climate change by totally removing themselves from society, living off the grid, and living in an utterly sort of sustainable closed loop way.
Although they do more than just try to set an example, they take direct political action, right?
Well, that's also true, yes. So another thing they do is they go, in one point, and it happens off screen in a way, like it's not dramatized, it's told in summary, but they go chain themselves together and sit on a mountain to try to halt some mountaintop removal, and they do other sort of dubious direct actions to try to stop environmental degradation.
Did your sense of our future change at all and through the course of, as a result of writing this novel?
Yeah, it did. And like when I knew less about climate change, I found it much more terrifying. And as I researched it more and thought about how it'd play out in this community, there's a three-word phrase from John Holdren, who was a climate advisor to Obama, and he said, in order to deal with climate change, we have to mitigate, adapt, and suffer, and we'll have to do all three. And, you know, we'll try to mitigate first and try to adapt, and suffering will also happen no matter what. And, you know, there's a cold hope in that phrase that, and definitely writing this book gave me hope, because I do think that people have the tools to address this issue that we've also created.
Molly Dektar, born and raised in Durham, North Carolina. Now she's out with her first book, The Ash Family. Molly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
You can find out more about the book at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holub-Mormon, and Josie Taras is also on board today. Robin Copley is our technical director, as always, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.